morning, and you are listening to the Peter Eichmann Show. This is Scooter.
And this is Peter.
And we're coming live from the Ivory Tower in the third floor of the Cub to you until 9 o'clock.
Yes, we are.
You can reach us on the telephone at area code 509-397-55...
Where'd that come from?
Okay, that's a different number. Let's try that again. 509-335-2207.
That is good.
I guess you're going to call me at work if I gave you that other one. You can reach us on the web at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES, as in the Peter Eichmann Show. The website is back up.
It's up and running.
Yes. And we also have the last couple shows up on the recorded and up there as well. You can also get our message board at www.witsybanter.com. Go into Interbanter and you will see the Peter Eichmann Show. You can also get there from our website. I'd like to give a couple PSAs real fast here. Police Regional Crisis Line, when you need to talk. Area code 509-332-1505. 24 hours a day, serving WSU, U of I, Women, and Lake Talk County. The Multicultural Student Ball is coming up Saturday, April 27th, from 8 p.m. to midnight in the Cub Ballroom. Buy your tickets in the Cub Tuesday the 23rd and Wednesday the 24th. And be sure to bring a can of food to get your tickets at a discount price. All the money gathered will be donated to charity. All canned food gathered will be donated to the Pullman Food Bank. And by going to the dance, you promote diversity on campus and taking a break from the worries of finals week. So be sure to come and check it out. Having trouble getting the word out about your club or event? Well, KZUU can help. KZUU offers public service announcements free of charge to people just like you who are looking to get the word out. Come fill out a form available every day outside the Cup Room 311. Thank you. All righty. Real quick, brief side. Well, no, let's talk about the show for today. We are going to talk about the national ID card idea. We talked about this back in February.
Back in the beginning,
Some new stuff has come out, and we want to sort of recap what we had talked about before and add the new stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, you know, it was one of our first shows, and
we didn't really do it justice. We put a lot of time in on this. I mean, you know, multiple. Oh, gosh. We put in more hours on that one section than we normally put in on a whole show. And we usually put in probably 3 to 4 hours a week, if not more, outside. So we put in, two or three
long
days.
Long time.
Yeah. And, you know, so we sort of think we should be able to use it a second time anyhow. That will be the first hour here. We will follow that up with tiny bit of tech news. There wasn't a lot out there that was of much interest.
Yeah, more good old ZDNet against Microsoft. But
yeah, there wasn't just about much of anything anywhere, though. I mean, everything was sort of blah as far as news went, technology-wise. And finally, we will end off with, well, we have an update on last week's section about the flag burning over in Moscow, Idaho. There's been an update on that, and stay tuned for that around the 8 o'clock hour. Following that, we will talk more in depth about the shooting that took place in King County. Stay tuned.
Should be good.
Welcome back. And that was, of course, our favorite,
the Reverend.
Alrighty. Let's get into our talk on the national ID card. I guess what we'll first do is just talk a little bit about the background of the national ID card, what it's all about, what it means to you and I, what it means to everybody, and talk about why it's not a good idea.
All right.
Very good. Okay. The national ID card is essentially like a driver's license, but it has a barcode or something that holds biometric information, which are things like fingerprints or retinal scans. As well as a photograph. It would include a unique identifier like a social security number that commercial and law enforcement officials could use to run through a database to check your background, your immigration status, tax records, credit history, all that kind of good
Everything.
Stuff. And in the last 30 years, actually, there's been several ideas and several attempts at getting a national ID card. But they keep on getting rejected by both the Republican and Democratic administrations.
That's one of the keys here is that people people seem to think that this is a new initiative.
Right.
That they're trying to do this because of September 11th.
Right.
That's not the case.
No, it's not the case. They've been wanting this for years. But, I mean, right now, the reason why there's a big push is because of the World Trade Center, September 11th.
But it's not a new idea.
Right. It's been there, like we said, for about 30 mm-hmm. years. I'm sure it's been there longer, but for the last 30 years, they've been shooting it down. Most Americans are afraid of what happened and are willing to give up their personal liberties to get a quote-unquote sense of security. Some people view the Social Security number as being the de facto identification number. So to them, hey, we already have one. Might as well just add a little bit more information, make it a little bit more secure.
Yes, ignorance is bliss.
Okay, and I guess our whole entire thesis might lie on this one statement from the a website, Washington State Citizens Against a National ID Card. Under the guise of safety and security, you are asked to give up your most personal information for the government's safekeeping. Using the government's favorite phrase, quote, the need to know, quote, we don't feel the government has the need to know such personal information. The fundamental right to privacy is asked to give away in order to achieve an illusion of security. How true. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what kind of ID we currently have.
You have your driver's license, which has your picture, your identification. Some of them now even have your Social Security number on them.
Right. Well, I don't think they're supposed to, though.
No, it's optional.
Some of the states, like Idaho, used to use Social Security number as the driver's license number, and that has gone away.
That's gone away. Right. You have a distinct driver's license number, but now they're also offering, as a service, to put your Social Security number on your card.
What a great service, eh?
Yeah, it's so nice of them to be so concerned about me.
Right. And driver's licenses now more and more coming out with magnetic strips or the 1 or 2D
and
barcode
2D barcodes and stuff.
And the difference between a 1D and a 2B, a 1D barcode is just the straight lines like you see on the UPCs in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
A 2D barcode looks like it went through the fax machine. I mean, it has all these like weird blobs on either side of those lines.
It looks like static,
yeah,
on a TV screen or something.
So,
yeah.
There's that's sort of the difference between the one.
Yeah, my new license has that, actually.
Yes. I think the state of Washington either has that or they have the magnetic bar.
Mine has that, too.
See, I don't have the Washington one yet,
so
the new one, at least.
Yeah, I'm all hooked up that way.
Right.
They
also hold the biometric information, which was once again fingerprints.
Yeah.
DNA, facial structure.
That's one
iris
of the big
scans.
Things with this national ID card.
Yeah, huge.
The reason people are trying to suggest driver's license should become the national ID card because they're already moving that way and implementing it.
Right.
You know, when I went in to renew my license in Colorado, you know, I had to put my finger on the little pad and they scan that. And I was talking with the guy and he told me that, well, that's one of the things that actually goes on my license now with that magnetic strip is that fingerprint that they take. Now, granted, it's only one finger, my right index finger.
Yeah, but that's your trigger finger.
Yep, and that's probably why they do that right there.
I'm sure it is. They
but
should
I
ask, are you left or right-handed?
Yeah.
All right, put your finger on the dot.
But, I mean, so they're already moving that way, and that's what's so scary. People don't realize it. You know,
right.
They just go to the driver's license, they're like, oh, well, nothing big happening here. I always go to my driver's license and give them all this information. And they're just moving towards a national ID card with that.
Right. I mean, it doesn't seem like anybody questions what they have to give when they give their information. They get a driver's license. They just, you know, hey, that's just...
That's one of the things
status quo.
You have to have it. I mean, what can you do without a driver's license? Or so people think. And so they're always going down and they don't really complain. And even if they wanted to complain, there's not really a whole lot they can do just there at the driver's license. You know, you have to start making an effort long before you actually go down to fill out the form, get together with your groups and stuff.
Right. And one of the problems with this whole entire national ID card situation is essentially you're bringing together a data warehouse,
mm-hmm.
you know, and essentially a database, pretty much anything used to store information about, like subjects, for instance, your driver's license is stored in a database. And in that database, it has your driver's license number, your name, your address, your phone number. Well, usually not your phone number. Maybe it does. And other such information about you. And in Peter's case, his fingerprint. And all that information is stored in this handy-dandy database. Well, by having these this idea of a national ID card, all those pieces of information about the Americans in the different states will be brought more closely together than they currently are. And then it can start to be tracked a lot more easy with other pieces of information. Essentially, when this is all said and done, and with a little bit more work on, you know, essentially every time you use your credit card, there's something in the database. This morning, the Peter man entered himself in the database twice by swiping a card in the readers on the doors to get into the studio. So they know that Peter was here at the certain times. Everything that you do that you use some sort of card reader, you've tracked exactly where you've been. And these databases coming together, they can they can be used to observe your habits and your activities anytime, anywhere. Every time you use a cell phone.
Yeah.
Every time you use
your
Safeway
card,
like the Peter man.
People think that we're sounding paranoid here. You know, you're saying, well,
we are paranoid.
You have all this different information. Nobody's going to take the time to try and track you on that. Well, this is the thing. With a national ID card, like Scooter over there said, it all comes in one place. All the information goes to one central database.
Right.
And so there's no longer this massive amount of manpower needed to search out over all these different databases to start tracking you. They just need one computer program that can go through one database, and they can track anything they want about you. And that's one of the big things that people need to put in perspective here and realize what can happen.
It's like the Truman Show for an unknown national audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's watching over you and all your personal exploits, all your personal information? Who's able to get a hold of that? I mean, essentially, advertisers can get it for their own gain, but who else can get it?
Yeah.
I mean, as it is, we have enough advertising intrusion into life.
Yeah,
you
I don't
really need
that
much more. Your privacy is being totally eroded away.
Yeah, because with the national ID card, they want it so that whenever you have to show an ID for anything, you know, writing a check, going to the movie, going to Blockbuster, buying groceries, whatever, anytime that you have to show an ID at the airport, they would have it where you'd swipe the magnetic code, or they'd have a bar reader, they'd read the information, you put like your thumb or have a retinal scan, one of the two is your biometric information, they'd verify your thumbprint or your retinals, and then that would let you through. All that information, like Scooter said, the time, the place, what you were doing, how much you spent, if it happens to be a transaction, what you bought, if you're at a grocery store, will be tracked in a government database. Now, is that the kind of thing that you want happening?
Right. And you know, each by themselves might not be that big of a deal. Who cares if Safeway knows that you bought a thing of cottage cheese and crackers on the 23rd? But when it starts to matter when they come together, then your life starts being folded out before people's eyes. And here's a quote from an article called Resist Enumeration from Coletta Bruick, project manager for the IRS's document processing system. Excuse me. We know everything about everyone that we need to know. Your employer tells us everything about you we need to know. Your activity records on your credit card tells us everything we need to know about you. Through interface with Social Security, the DMV, and your banking institutions, we really have a lot of information. This is the IRS
speaking.
And then also a quote from Paul Rogers and Elsie Ackerman in the article, Oracle Boss Urges National ID Cards and Offers Free Software. First off, we just need to put a big thumbs down to Mr. Larry Ellison from Oracle. He is a bad man.
Yes, he is.
He's taking an angle on this, and he's looking to make a lot of money like he tried to do in California, mm-hmm. which is another side issue, which we might get to in the tech area. Anyway, calls for a national ID card have traditionally been met with fierce resistance from civil liberties groups, who says the cards would be used to intrude on the privacy of Americans and would allow the government to track people's movements, which, once again, they would.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellison said, in the electronic age, little privacy is left.
Anyway, you got to get
Anyway.
Because that's so important. He's saying, like...
Anyway,
since We're losing it anyway. We might as well just give it all up. What's it really matter?
And when we give it up, we might as well use my database system to hold the information.
Yeah, I like that. Oh, no. I'm not taking a business angle on this. I'm just Larry Ellison trying to donate free software that I will charge to maintain.
Yeah. And the other thing is like, okay, so it's his software. Does he have a back door?
Yeah.
Is he able to get into this database?
Good questions. Good questions, because once there's a central database like that, everybody's going to want information from it.
Right.
You know, selling that out to the highest bidder is going to make billions of dollars.
Well, we're not saying Larry would do that.
Oh, no.
No.
But the possibility exists.
Uh-huh. Right. Maybe somebody within the company. But, you know, I don't believe that Larry Ellison is doing this out of the niceness of his heart for the better of America.
Me neither. Not
he
at
has
all.
An angle on this. And I think Larry Ellison's angle is that of, let's get really rich off of the guise of, oh, let's give you some free software.
Security.
Free
let's get rich off the guise software. Of security.
Free software.
Because that's all it is.
See, I think they'd be better off using SQL Server. Then they'd have to pay for it, and then we don't have this little hands to hide behind your back, pay them whatever they demand for help. Because, you know, the software is free. They didn't say anything about the tech support.
Yeah.
And that's the big thing. So, and then another issue comes up when you get to databases is who's going to verify this data? Is it going to be good data or bad data?
That is correct, yeah.
I mean, you always hear commercials about the credit card companies and how, I checked my credit report and I found it missing this or I found this in error and I was able to, you know, and it's like, well, if they're having these kinds of problems with credit reports.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like right here, according to the 1998 study conducted by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, found that 70% of all credit reports contain errors, and 29% of the errors are serious enough to prevent someone from obtaining a loan. I mean, this is a private industry that's put together a database for credit card companies so that they can know whether you're safe to give a loan to or not, and they don't even get it right. 70% contain errors.
Right.
Now think of a government database, which means that it's millions times bigger with bureaucracy and more complicated just to, off the get-go. And then take the fact that you're going to be tracking every aspect of someone's life. The chances of not having an error are astronomical. I mean, there's going to be so many errors in this thing, they're going to have full-time people just to sit there and answer phones. Hello, what's your error? May I help you?
Yeah, and it's not the thing is that it's not a joke. You know, it's put in by human beings. Mm-hmm. And as we know, human beings make errors. And those errors will show up on these reports. It's just a matter of fact.
Yep.
Essentially, when you have this database, like we sort of alluded to earlier with Larry Ellison and having some sort of back door onto this to get it, what kind of safeguards are going to be put on in such a way that nobody can hack into this? And if somebody does hack in, you know, they then could add, delete, change data in this database. And if this is undetected, your life. I mean, they sort of joked about this in the movie Hackers, where they took this guy and they made him appear to be dead and they canceled all his credit cards and stuff, and this guy had all these difficulties. But with a national ID card and a tying of all these databases, that's reality.
It could be done, yeah.
It's reality.
Real easily. And how do you prove to the imperial government, who knows everything, that your data is wrong? I mean, how can you go to them and say, no, you have that wrong in there?
Right, I mean,
I'm really this way.
Who's going to prove that it's correct? I mean, do you have to go to court and prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or by preponderance of the evidence that this fact is untrue? I mean, how are you going to prove some of this stuff?
Because I mean, your national ID card is what's true. That's the whole idea behind it. According to what they're saying in all these articles, is that the national ID card is you. It contains everything about you so that we can verify that's you. So if you and the national ID card disagree, who are they going to blame? They can blame the database or you. I think it's going to be you.
And that's
the problem.
And, you know, questions that you might want to ask yourself are what privileges and rights to read from this database? I mean, to see your own personal information, what rights and privileges will you have? What information is going to be stored? How will the data be accessible? How does an individual know what is contained on their ID card? How can an individual correct mistakes that appears on their NID record, national ID card record? I mean, these are questions you might want to think about because they are going to be facing you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you have a national ID card and the information that's stored on it, let's just say that they have your physical description, a picture, biometric, like a thumbprint, and your credit history and medical history. We'll just say that that's contained on your card. You go to the movie theater, and in order to get in, you have to swipe your card. Okay, what does that reader at the movie theater get off your card? Are they able to access that you're who you say you are? You know, would they be able to access that I'm Peter Eichmann? Well, probably. Would they be able to access my medical history? That's a good question. I mean, what kind of safeguards, as Scooter alluded to, are going to be put in so that we can determine who reads our information? Because I can tell you that if my entire history is on this card, I do not want the local 7-Eleven knowing my life history when I cash a check.
Right. And you know, the funny thing is, it's them that I'm not necessarily worried about. It's those who I don't know that I'm worried about. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this. And who is it that is advocating us going to a national ID card?
Stay tuned.
That's rock and roll.
That's our Reverend.
That's our Reverend.
Reverend Horton Heat. One of the favorites of the Peter Eichmann Show.
Absolutely. I hope you memorize the lyrics by now. Yeah.
Well, we'd always do Barstow, too, if I could ever find that CD.
Find the CD again. I don't know what happened to it.
I need to get the Peter Man over here looking for it.
Well, I've looked where it should be, you know.
Yeah.
You have Barstow, which was by Jay Farrar.
Should be under J or F
somewhere in the studio, but I have...
Under the J's or the F's, yeah.
Yet to find it.
Maybe it's a possibility they gave it away or something. I really don't know.
It was maybe everybody thought it was terrible.
Hey, now, Barstow is good. Everybody on the show who listened to the show liked Barstow.
Oh, yeah.
So remember that.
Was that a poll that you conducted?
Yeah, a one-man poll.
Okay.
Who here doesn't like Barstow? Raise your hand. And nobody did. Therefore, I know everybody did like it.
There you go.
Okay, we got to do a quick PSA here. KZUU is now accepting summer applications. If you are interested in beginning your on-air personality here at KZUU, come by the Cub Room 311 or get it online at www.kzuu.org. We hire a wide variety of people, and we would like to hear from you. So come on and jump aboard the KZUU bandwagon. And one thing I'd like
You're just trying to confuse people today. 397-111.
I know. I just don't want any other people on the show but us.
I know.
We want to dominate the airways. No, anyway.
We want to dominate the airways.
If you want to reach us by telephone, you can get a hold of us at 509-335-2207. On the web, www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES is in the Peter Eichmann Show. And
that is up and running now.
This is up and running.
Yes.
And you can go in there and look at our biography. You can download old parts of the show. You can see what some of our old guests and a lot of our sources for our news articles and whatnot that we've had throughout.
Yeah,
and
it's a really good site. I'd recommend checking it out.
Frequently
for sure.
Asked questions about the show. As well as our, other stuff. It's pretty much the show encapsulated
all
in that show.
All-inclusive website.
Right. Anyway, and that takes a lot of time to do, unfortunately. I think next year I'm going to have to use a database to make it a little easier. And, secondly, we'd like to say that we have a website that you can chat with us on at www.witsybanter.com. You can get to the direct link to our message board by going through our website, or you could go through wittybanter.com and look for the link called Interbanter, and then look for the Peter Eichmann Show. And there you will be able to talk Peter Eichmann Show stuff.
Yes, you can.
If you have any comments about this national ID card, go ahead and give us a call, or you can, once again, get us on the message board and leave a message there. We do periodically check it throughout the show, and once in a while... When somebody actually does leave a message, we've had one. We actually read it on the air, so we'd be more than willing to do so with
So
other
we
messages.
Do it. It has happened before. But and you could be that person.
Unfortunately, the only message left was from a guy that I know, and he said the show sucked. Yeah, he was listening about 6:15 in the morning or something like that. Anyway, Getting back to our national ID card, you know, once again, national ID card.
I wanted to say another thing here.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Before we went on to who's promoting it and some of the other problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people think, or at least I've been told, that this is a slippery slope. You know, we're saying they come back
slippery
and say...
Slippery slope fallacy, which means a step in a direction will inevitably lead to that ending, which is a fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, Peter's going
to
argue
that. Well, I've had a lot of people tell me that because they come to me and they say, no, we're not trying to track every aspect of your life, or the government's not... I haven't actually talked to government people, so it'd be people saying, the government's not trying to track every aspect of your life. We just want to have a card with some biometric information on it, like your driver's license.
Okay.
And so that we can verify who you are.
We don't want to track you. We just want to verify who you are.
Yes, exactly. That's how they say it.
And how do you verify who somebody is? By getting all their personal information stored in a database so you can later call it up after it's been confirmed.
Exactly.
Once.
But here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of how the government always works towards overstepping their boundaries and expanding their power is the FBI criminal database. And as part of the FBI criminal database, you have the short-term database for background checks on gun purchases. So when you go to purchase a gun, at least I don't know if it's this way in Washington, but in Colorado it was an instant background check. You'd fill out the form with all your information, and then the dealer would call up the FBI or through the state, and they would tell them your information, your Social Security number, driver's license number. They would give their federal firearms license number so that they could be verified by the state and the government. And the government would come back within 10 minutes, the FBI, and they would tell the dealer whether or not you were verified to have a gun. And if you followed me through all that, you're a genius. Basically, they verified to see that you were not a ex-con and that you could have a gun. This database was supposed to be destroyed within a year. It was always supposed to be destroyed so that you'd never have anything older than a year in there. Recently, Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts and Chuck Schumer got together and decided, well, you know, with September 11th, we really ought to have a bill that makes that permanent record so that the FBI can access it and see who's bought guns. Because usually when you're at that stage and the dealer calls in for the background check, you've pretty much agreed to buy the gun and have the cash on the table, you know, the check written, whatever. So if you're in there, chances are you bought that gun. And they were trying to make this permanent law. So that would be mandated registration of all firearms. And that would be against everything that the NRA has been fighting for so long and that I'm against. The point here is that the government does overstep their boundaries. Luckily, and this is kind of hard to say luckily, but with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's happened and the U.S. immersion in that and trying to resolve that, this bill got shoved to the back and it hasn't really been touched on
also
a lot.
Interesting about that is what we talked about last week is how the number of people who have purchased guns since September 11th has dramatically gone through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And we know this because we probably have records of sales and things like that. I mean, we're probably not talking the back alley black market thing.
Yeah.
So I would have to venture and guess that the majority of the people who buy guns through legal sources legally can own them.
Oh, absolutely. That's why they buy them legally.
Right. And so it's sort of interesting, though, that we'd want to track in a database all these people who have legally purchased these guns.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it just shows how the government is always trying.
One thing that we ought to
put in
databases is everybody who rents Ryder trucks. That way we can...
a lot more dangerous.
And then we could do background checks on those people as well.
Yeah. Because, you know, like I've been reading a lot in the news, everybody's scared to death of these small planes. A Ryder truck...
That's true. Small planes.
Explosives.
Yes.
Can do exponentially more damage than a small plane could ever do if it were loaded to the hilt. Because a plane still has to take off, which means it can't be completely packed full of explosives.
Yeah. But anyway, I just real quickly... That's fine. I didn't do this at the top of the hour, and I didn't do it at our 40-minute break. But I need to let you know, this is the Peter Eichmann Show. You're listening to KZUU 90.7 FM. And all views and opinions on the Peter Eichmann Show are those of the Peter Man and Scooter and do not reflect those of KZUU, its management, WSU, the Cub, or any other entity involved with Washington State University.
That is correct.
Thank you.
And we are still coming to you live
from the
Ivory Towers.
Okay, getting back on with back on track.
Yes.
With the national ID card. One of the things that the question that you might want to ask is why is there this push for a national ID card? Is it because people just like standards? Because people think that the federal government does things better?
I hope not.
No, I think, and I believe the reason why everybody's pushing, not everybody, but there are people who are pushing for national ID card. There are some people who have their angles,
mm-hmm.
but I think a lot of them are pushing for it because they feel that they'll be safer if there's a national ID card. And once again, the safety is an illusion.
Yeah, it is. It's an complete illusion.
So the question is, how does knowing who somebody is make you safe?
It doesn't. It's straight up. It doesn't. You know, I think you actually said this on our first show, but if a known terrorist like Osama bin Laden is sitting next to me on my plane, knowing who he is doesn't make me any safer. You know?
Knowing he has no weapons
is what makes me
safer.
Exactly.
Right. Or not even knowing, just that the fact he has no weapons is what makes you safe.
Yeah. It's not knowing that he has no weapons. It's not knowing who he is. None of that makes me safe. The fact that he will have no weapons because of security screening is what makes me safe. Not the fact that he was tracked all the way to the airport and that they know who he is because of his thumbprint. No.
Right. And Larry Ellison, the CEO of Article, says, I think 99.99% of Americans will want these ID cards, which is interesting because I guess the Peterman and I are the ones who make that 0.01% not there, because he seems to think, I don't know where he would get that kind of figure unless he's pulling it out of the air.
Well, it was one of those polls like you just did. Everybody who doesn't like Barso, raise your hand. There you go, 100%.
Yes. Wouldn't you feel better if everyone who walked into an airport showed their ID card and put their thumb on a scanner, and you knew they were who they said they were?
No.
Once again, no.
No.
I don't care who it is. Even if it's Ted Kennedy, I won't feel any safer knowing who he is.
That's true.
Anyway, going on from there, the information, and this is the interesting thing, Jane Black from an article, Don't Make Privacy the Next Victim of Terror, talked about how information about these people were publicly available. It didn't make us any safer.
It's called the Yellow Pages, or the White Pages, I mean.
Open the San Diego White Pages, turn to the A's. You'll find a listing for Nawak Al-Zihimi, or Al-Hamzi, excuse me, Al-Hamzi. Everything you wanted to know about his whereabouts were right there in black and white. 6401 Mount Ada Road, San Diego, California. Al Hamzi was one of the hijackers on American Airlines Flight 77 that killed 68 passengers on board and 125 people on the ground when it crashed in the Pentagon September 11th. Alleged ringleader Mohammed Atta and other suspects used their debit cards to rent cars in the months before the attack.
Yeah. That just goes to show you that this whole knowing who people are thing is bogus. It doesn't make you safe at all, because we knew who those people were. It was, we didn't know the intentions.
And here's the thing. To put your whole entire, put your faith in a card is what's scary, because here's why.
Well, even before we go on to that, I just want to say one more thing about the open thing that's happened here that's recently, with recent airport security and the different safeguards that were supposed safeguards that were implemented for people and travelers on who got a more intense screening. You know, you couldn't give someone more screening because they were Arab and had long beards with Mohammed in their name, between the ages of 26, male, which classifies, you know, 99% of the people on the United States Most Wanted list. You couldn't give them extra screening for that. But if they paid cash for the ticket and got one way, then you could. All of the hijackers for September 11th bought round-trip tickets using credit cards.
Very interesting.
Yes. So all the safeguards as of recent have been bogus, but that's just another example. You know?
Okay. I think the biggest thing is that everybody's putting their whole faith in this idea of a national ID card.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why it's scary. Okay, if a person has them backing, if the person has the money backing,
like terrorists
do, they would have the ability to forge such a card if they have the money backing. They can buy computer systems, which actually criminals currently are able to get a hold of, and they could make their own ID card. And if everybody's faith is that if that card says the person is who they say they are, then why worry? Because the database is there. The card can't be wrong because it's a national ID card, so there's no way possible that could be forged.
Yeah.
Nah.
Not like a driver's license or a Social Security that numbers that get stolen every day.
Right. No, you can't forge it. If it becomes a national ID card, it can't be forged.
Yep.
It's impossible.
Well,
totally impossible.
Unless you have a lot of money and resources, which terrorists just don't have,
of course, according to these people.
Because, you know, right. Osama bin Laden, even though he's the son of a Saudi billionaire, and he himself
he's
is
poor.
A billionaire, yeah. he doesn't have the resources
doesn't
to
have the resources.
Forge a card
like this. No, these are inforgeable.
Yeah.
I mean, think about what the government's going to spend on each card. I'm sure it's going to be about $500 million a card or something like that.
Probably knowing the bureaucracy.
Well, no, but getting a little bit more serious for a second here. With the idea that people can forge these cards, here's what I was talking about is there was an story on Dateline NBC where they didn't show exactly the whole entire process because they didn't obviously want make criminals out of people, but they took the slider card from a hotel room with a magnetic strip,
mm-hmm.
turned it into a credit card, an ATM card, and went and withdrew money from a plastic card with a magnetic strip. The way they did this was there's simply a laptop with a card reader and a software program that will take the information from one card, store it, and then put the information out on the next.
And that gives you confidence.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like, it's not that hard.
Uh-uh.
It's a magnetic strip.
It's available technology.
So all I have to do is take this card, take the information from it, put it on something else, and put it back on a card. It's not that hard. Somebody with some technology background and a little bit of money can do it.
I was about to say, you know, you can buy card readers.
Mm-hmm.
They are rather on the expensive side, but with backing, I mean,
and
if
they're
I'm
not
a terrorist,
actually they're not all that expensive either.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're not that expensive, but your average person probably isn't going to be able to go out and buy one. Or if they are, it's going to be in place of their car. But so you can buy one of those. You can buy hotel cards, those actual hotel cards with the magnetic strips and packs of like 70, and they're really cheap. They're like 10 cents a piece after shipping. I mean, this is available technology that people already have for forging a supposedly inforgeable card that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Yeah.
And going along with that, it's, you know, I guess one of the people who are for the national ID card always throw this question in the face of those who are against it. What? Do you have something to hide?
Yeah, I hate that.
You know, and it's like, no, I have nothing to hide, but I don't want to turn this into some England where you have video cameras tracking my every movement. I have nothing to hide.
Or satellites. They started that recently.
I have nothing to hide, but I also have personal liberties, and I think those need to be protected.
Exactly.
Nobody needs to know what I'm doing when I go from point A to point B.
To a little quote to throw out here, those who would trade liberty for security deserve neither liberty nor security.
Why would they not deserve either?
Because if you're not willing to fight for what you have, and if you're not willing to stand up for your liberty, and you're willing to just trade it away for security, I mean, a fascist ruler, a dictator can give you security. You know, if you're a peasant to a king, you have, quote-unquote, security, because when you go to war, you're fighting for all of your land and everything. But if you're willing to trade up all of your personal liberties, then you're going to lose them all, and you don't really deserve either of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really that simple.
Okay. And here's a question that you can ask anybody. This is the question that when they say, what do you have to hide? This is what you respond back to them after you explain to them that you have nothing to hide, but your personal liberties should come before the government's ability to track you from point A to point B. Then you ask them, what are you planning on doing with the information that you get from me? And if the answer is nothing, then you should follow up it then why is it necessary?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you plan on doing with this information, this biometric information, this information, personal information about my life? If they don't have any plans for it, then why in the heck do they need it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, this sort of links sort of as a bridge here, although I don't want to get too far off topic, with the WSU, what was it, ResLife. I can't think of the names here.
Residential Life, yes.
Yes. Their plans to implement card readers to replace physical keys.
Right.
And the great thing, as Scott Scooter over there just said, is they want to track the information so that they know exactly when you enter the building and so that they know what time, whose card was used, all that. Now, here's the thing. If they were just for locks, as they claim, why do they have to store all the information? Why do they have to have it go to their database and be recorded? All they should need is my card being valid for that card, that one card reader.
Right.
That's all they should need. But by tracking it, they're telling us, well, we have another plan in mind. You know, they can say we're just doing it because we can. They can yada, 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 and you can watch the lips move. But the truth is, if they're tracking it, they have a reason other than letting you in the building.
That's true.
Exactly.
And we will go to a break. It's the top of the hour, 7 o'clock. We have a couple songs to play. And when these songs are over with, we will come back and finish up our discussion on the National ID card and go on to tech issues. And, of course, ending the show, we will talk an update about the flag over in Moscow, Idaho, the burning of the gay flag, and finish off with the shooting.
We'll move into our shooting.
The shooting by a deputy, not of a deputy.
Yes.
To level the playing field for the average citizen when they are confronted unfairly by the massive power of the criminal justice system. This is not an attempt to say that the police and the criminal justice workers are the sole parties to blame when things go wrong, but we are saying that these are the people whose salaries that we pay out of public funds to preserve and protect and provide a service to our community. The minimum we can expect in return is a degree of accountability that we, as their employers, have the right to respect. It is we, the people, in a democracy that should set practices and policies of our employees. We cannot and should not tolerate public employees who insist on having the mindset of us against them with the result of that public service end up at war with the very community they're supposed to save, which is sort of interesting because up above that, essentially he's saying it's us against them. We're trying to level the playing field. If you're leveling a playing field, you're talking us against them. So he himself is talking about us against them. He's talking about, quote unquote, leveling the playing field. What he's talking about is, as a police officer, when you pull a car over and you run the license plate of that car, it comes up with the name and the address of the person that you're stopping. And then you know where that person lives, or you know where that person's address is, or whatever else like that. Now, if that police officer gets pulled over, the same thing happens to him. It's not like he has some special privilege that his stuff won't show up on that computer database. But why would a cop need to know that information, you might wonder, when they pull somebody over?
Not really. It's sort of important.
Why?
You know? Well, if someone is pulled over, and when they run the information,
mm-hmm.
they'll find out if the car's stolen or not,
okay.
if the person has any arrest warrants out
right,
for them,
right?
All the legal stuff like that. I mean,
that seems like a good idea to find that kind of stuff
out. Yeah, exactly. When you pull someone over for a traffic violation, it shouldn't just be a blind stop. Where I mean, and I use that in the sense where you just walk up, write him a ticket, and bye. You should be able to see if he is wanted in several states or not.
Right.
Makes sense to me.
Okay. And so their way of leveling the playing field is putting that cop's address on the internet.
Yeah, I think he's got some weird ideas of how that levels the playing field. Not going to agree that the guy's sane, but or even smart.
He's not sane. He's not smart, but he's there.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's stop for a few minutes, play a couple preview tracks, and we'll come back with sports.
All right.
Oh.
Negative.
Quarterback war going on the field. Either we have two defenses or we have two great quarterbacks. We can go back to like Boomer Esiason and Joe Montana. They put on a great show when the 49ers and Bengals met up back in the early 90s, and that was a great Super Bowl. For any football fan out there who wasn't a direct fan of these two teams, this probably was a great Super Bowl. 17-17 going into the final minute of the game. I mean, what more could you ask for if you're going to watch the entire game?
Well, one thing I'm sort of curious about is I wonder if they could play the final 2 seconds of that game like the Cougars got hosed out of 2 seconds in Rose Bowl 1998. I was watching, and on the replays, I saw it over and over and over again. It appeared that after the ball was well between those uprights, there were still 2 seconds ticking away on that clock. Why did they not have one opportunity to run a ball back off of a kickoff for a touchdown or anything like that? Granted, it would have been a very rare thing for it to happen to run it back, but I thought there were 2 seconds on the clock. And as far as I'm concerned, we now have the Rose Bowl 1998, which is still in limbo because that game has never really been finished. And now Super Bowl is also in limbo because there are 2 seconds on that field waiting to be played.
Well, it seems to me like officials always make mistakes in football. It just seems like they're always the ones that are making the bad call. I mean, if we can think back, Seahawk fans, to a game against the New York Jets a couple of years ago, Vinny Testaverde takes the ball.
You know those white footballs.
He runs up to the end zone, and he trips up. Two people tackle him from behind, and he lands on, like, the one-yard line. I was, like, cheering my butt off, thinking about this as, oh, the Seahawks are going to make the playoffs all right. And then suddenly I see the official on the other sideline with his arms in the air signaling touchdown. The Seahawks are going berserk, and the Jets, they kind of looked surprised that it was called a touchdown. Now, everybody knows that Vinny Testaverde was down on the one-yard line, and this was a blown call. The league never admitted it, but the Seahawks didn't make the playoffs because of this one loss.
And wasn't that a Cougar alumni coach also get fired at the end of that season? Dennis Erickson? That was the end of his four-year career in Seattle.
That's correct. Yeah, it was sad to see him go, and in come the days of Mike Holmgren. Now, he might have been a really good coach over in Green Bay, and he might be a good coach now, but he's a terrible general manager. The players he brings into this team, they're not doing anything for us. I mean, given John Randall, he was a really good pickup, but really Holmgren had nothing to do with it. John Randall knew a couple of people on the team, and he favored Seattle over everybody else, so pretty much Holmgren only had to say, okay, you can play for the team. Sean Alexander was a mistake as well. They actually drafted him low in the first round of the draft, and they weren't really looking for him to be a starting running back. They were looking to trade him. And all of a sudden, Sean Alexander becomes really good, and Holmgren doesn't know what to do with him. He has Ricky Waters signed to the second highest running back salary in the league, only behind Marshall Faulk. And you really can't do anything but play him. I mean, you put him on the bench, and that makes you look bad for paying this guy all this money just to sit on the bench. So Sean Alexander was really at the short end of the stick here. We're talking about Seattle things. Let's go on to basketball. We have a really great news to report here. I mean, on January 31st, that was last week, the Washington State Cougars hosted the Washington Huskies. And we were in for a great game. They came in, and obviously they expected to win. Washington State hadn't won a Pac-10 game yet, and we weren't looking like we were going to win this one starting in the first half. We kept it close, just like most of our games, but it didn't look like we had that one thing that was going to pull us ahead. It wasn't until the second half started, and we started to get a little bit closer, that the game really got interesting. The fans were really into it. And by halfway through the second half, with about 5:44 left, the Cougars took their first lead of the game at 68-66. The teams bounced back and forth, each team trading baskets, until like about a minute to go, and the Cougars took the lead. With 0.3 seconds to go, though, Marcus Moore fouled Will Conroy of the Washington Huskies on a three-point shot. The score was 81-78, and it looked like they were going to be able to tie the game up. Unfortunately for the Huskies, he missed the last two free throws, and the Cougars went on to win 81-79. Now, who do we have to thank for this game? One man and one man only.
That would be me, because I was the one who told him to miss.
I'm sorry. That would be Marcus Moore, playing the entire 40 minutes of this game. Now, he was a baller tonight. He went for a block shot. He had a steal, 3-for-7 from the three-point line, a couple of assists, a couple of rebounds, and he had 28 points. 28 points, which made him the leading scorer for the Cougars this season.
Well, what do you say about McNair's performance of 20 points?
Oh, he was really good in the middle. I mean, he was helping him out. Every time he got past the ball, he pretty much made it.
There's one little story I just wanted to talk about. I was there in the audience a couple rows back from the floor, and standing up the whole game, of course, until the girl behind us told us to sit down so she could see her cheerleaders. I was sort of curious why a girl wanted to see cheerleaders in their underwear. But anyway, getting back on with basketball, there we were watching the game, and this guy from the Huskies named Barnard, something like that. Anyway, he gets the ball, gets on a fast break. He's going down. He has one of those little, like, I don't know who he is. He's the guy that sings some songs. Anyway, he has this pencil-thin mustache or beard going all the way around. So he's looking like all Mr. Cool Guy. He's one of those dudes that wears his socks pulled all the way up, you know, and his shorts going down so you see about an inch of his knee. Anyway, he gets the ball. He's on a fast break. He's going down for the basket. And it appeared to me that he wasn't sure what the heck he was going to do once he got there. He wasn't sure if he was going to do a simple layup. Was he going to slam the ball? He wasn't sure. I think it became apparent that he wasn't sure when he sort of did a mixture between the two and missed.
By the way, how many points did he finish the game with?
0. He took a couple shots and he missed every single one.
I guess that means he must have been the MVP for the Huskies that night. Well, the Cougars did pull out the game, and Marcus Moore has a lot to say here. He now leads the Pac-10 in steals per game at 2.4. He is now second in the league in assists at about 5.5 a game. This looks really good for him, and he's having one of his best seasons yet. As a sophomore, we have a lot to look forward to with Mr. Moore here.
That's one thing that hopefully through the show and through just promotion that more and more people will start going to the Cougar games. It's very discouraging to see the difference between the Cougars now and the Cougars 10 years ago. Granted, we're talking about a team that had Benny Hill and another gentleman by the name of Seltzer. I'm losing his first name. Anyway, we had all these great players 10 years ago. We went to the NIT tournament. Beasley Coliseum, which holds, you know, a couple thousand people, would be filled. I mean, the upper sections, there's people sitting on all areas. The stadium was rocking. It was a lot of fun. You know, it was definitely a home court advantage. These days, they have plastic tarps and bags covering the seats in the upper sections almost all the way around the whole entire Martin Stadium at Friel Court. They have the student section. 10 years ago, you had to get, just like with football, you had to get to the game a couple hours before the gates even opened if you wanted to think about sitting on the wooden bleachers down below. You can now get there well after the gates open and get down there and sit a row or two back from the very front, from the floor. It's definitely a much different atmosphere. And I think that after this Husky game, the Cougs showed they have the ability. I mean, they played a good, hard game against the Huskies. They grounded out. The fans had a great time who were there. I walked away with a hoarse voice just like after football games. It was a great, great thing to see the fans who were there. They were all cheering, having a good time. And I think that more people going to those games would see that they do, indeed, have a great time at Cougar basketball game. Welcome back to the Peter Eichmann Show, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower in the third floor of the Cub. You can reach us on the web at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES, as in the Peter Eichmann Show. You can reach us by telephone at area code 509-335-2207, and you can reach us on the net at our message board at www.witsybanter.com.
Hit them all on the first try.
Yes, I did. It's sort of rare for that to happen these days.
That's awesome.
Alrighty. The Multicultural Spring Ball is coming up Saturday, April 27th, from 8 p.m. to midnight in the Cub Ballroom. Buy your tickets in the Cub Tuesday the 23rd and Wednesday the 24th, and be sure to bring a can of food to get your tickets at a discounted price. All the money gathered will be donated to charity, and all canned food gathered will be donated to the Pullman Food Bank. By going to the dance, you will be promoting diversity on campus while taking a break from the worries of finals week. So come out and check us out. Having trouble getting the word out about your club or event? Well, KZUU can help. KZUU offers public service announcements free of charge to people just like you who are looking to get the word out. Come fill out a form every day available outside of the Cub, room 311. Thank you. Once again, this is the Peter Eichmann Show, and all views and opinions expressed here are those of the Scooter and Peter Man, and do not reflect those of KZUU. It's people who are above them, the managers.
And affiliates.
Washington State University or the Compton Union Building.
That is correct. You have anything that you'd like to say to Mayor Scooter? As he said earlier, you can call us, or you can write to us, or you can email us, or you can talk to us on the message board, and we will respond.
Slowly but surely.
Yes, sometimes. Eventually.
Anyway, getting back to the issue of national
ID cards.
The question that we're going to have is, who is promoting all this national ID card stuff? As you know, the Peter Man and Scooter have so well had pointed out why it's such a bad thing.
Yes, it is.
And I'm going to take a leap here. The fact that nobody called in and disagreed with us, therefore means y'all agree.
That
right?
Y'all agree, of course. And it's y'all.
Y'all.
Y'all agree.
Y'all agree, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And just in case nobody does agree, one more interesting fact before we move on.
Okay, let's hear
it. Before we move on, as far as the terrorists go and the September 11th thing, 17 of the terrorists were not on any sort of list, so they would have been able to get real national ID cards. And in case you didn't know, at least 9 of the terrorists had real, not fake here, real state-issued Virginia driver's licenses. So, you know, if the terrorists can get real driver's licenses, I see no reason why they couldn't get real ID cards. Why fake them when you can get them real?
But the thing is, Peter, man, it was a state and not the national ID card.
Oh.
And that's actually being argued that that was a problem, that they got real state ID cards, and had there been a national ID card system, there's no way in the world they could have gotten them legally.
That's really interesting, because a lot of the national ID cards that are being proposed are being proposed having implementation at the state level based on driver's licenses. They say that's the easiest way to implement a nationwide national ID card, to move from driver's licenses, because everybody has a driver's license. So all these people that have real driver's licenses will be able to get real ID cards, and they'll still go off and do whatever they want, because no one will know any better.
Very good.
That was just an interesting point. Side note.
Very interesting.
Now on to who is promoting this stuff.
Okay, let's talk about Mr. Larry Ellison. Who is Larry Ellison? As we said earlier, he is the CEO of Oracle. What is Oracle? Oracle is a high-powered database program. Oracle is used by many, 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 many large companies. Oracle is the competitor with another program called SQL Server, which is another high-end database program put out by Microsoft. And if you're wondering exactly what a database program is, if you've ever used a program called Access, which is put out by Microsoft,
yes,
that is a database program. However, Access is like the little itty-bitty infant brother of these other applications called SQL Server and Oracle.
Well, Larry Ellison, I think, you know, we have a lot of stuff we can talk about with him. But
we could have a whole show on Larry Ellison.
I think we can sum... I mean, we'll talk more about him, but you can sum up Larry Ellison with one quote from Larry Ellison. Well, this privacy you're concerned about is largely an illusion. All you have to give up is your illusions, not any of your privacy.
Isn't that beautiful? Oh, the fact you don't have privacy, it's just an illusion.
Yeah.
Just give up that illusion, and you won't have to give up any privacy.
Yeah, I like how he says that.
Because according to him, you have none anyway.
Mm-hmm. That just goes back to his thing that he said earlier. It's just, people like that are just sickening to me. I mean, I know that he's playing it for an angle because he wants money.
Right. Well, you know,
but it's still sickening.
Here's what he says. I mean, one of his things in favor of it is, we need a database behind that. So when you walk into an airport, you say you are Larry Ellison. You take a card and put it through the reader and put your thumb down. The system confirms that this is Larry Ellison. And it's like, okay, so we need, and notice there's that database part. And that's where Larry Ellison comes in.
Exactly. That's what he wants. He wants the database because, as we said earlier, he'll graciously donate the software to prove to people that he's not in this for the money.
Right.
But upgrades and maintenance, service, tech support, all that good stuff, he's going to charge for.
Yeah, those won't be free.
Yeah.
He's only initially giving the software.
So I guess he's not really in it for reasons of security. Yeah. He's in it for money.
Right. He currently is worth $15 billion. But obviously that's enough. Because, I mean, think about it. If you get the gravy train of the United States national government giving you money, oh, my goodness gracious, you won't have to worry about anything anymore.
And like you said, he's in competition with Microsoft.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of these two programs has to be in. If he gets his program in, then they're going to be stuck with it because of the implementation of a new program.
Right.
And he's going to, like you said, have a gravy train. There won't be anybody who can touch him. And the only competition that would even have a chance is Microsoft. And once this is implemented, even they will not be able to overcome it because of costs.
And above and beyond that, there's an estimated $3 billion which will be spent on other hardware, software, and services that would go into just creating this smart card.
The system, yeah.
And, you know, I just, oh, man.
That seems like the biggest waste of $3 billion.
There's definitely money that people will gain if this goes through.
Absolutely. You wonder why people are pushing it? $3 billion.
You know what would be interesting is if they were to use Microsoft SQL Server, how for this would Larry Ellison be? I'm sure publicly he'd say, oh, yeah, that's fine, just as long as we have a national ID card. But I think in reality he's like, no, that's
bad. We really don't want a national ID card. We really don't need one at this
state. 99.99% of the Americans wouldn't want one. No, I
need to see him changing all that. No. We need to sit back and reevaluate the situation and try and figure out a better path for America and for personal liberty than a national ID card, at least at this time, until better alternatives can be developed by my company.
no kidding. And then you have the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, the AAMVA.
Very true. Very true. You know, they seem to think that the national ID card is the end-all to security. And I'm not even sure if they have a money issue. They just like the power that they'll get.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing. It's a public interest, or what is it? It's like a public interest group. It's not an actual government organization.
Yeah. It's a special interest group.
And they are looking at being power hungry.
Absolutely. They've been advocating this whole national ID thing for years, long before September 11th. They've been pushing it.
Right. And one of their quotes is, because the importance placed on one card, the national ID card, the AAMVA has the responsibility to do whatever it can to improve public safety and national security in North America. And it's responsibility?
Yeah, I was about to say, so how does this special interest group have a responsibility to do whatever it can to improve public safety? I mean, it doesn't seem like a special interest group has a responsibility to the American people to do things like that. I think that they're just after power because, you know, if Americans' driver's licenses are enhanced with the loads of this stored personal information that you would have with the ID card, the AAMVA would become more powerful and influential. I mean, it's really that simple. There's nothing more to it. They are power hungry. Ellison wants money. The AAMVA wants power. They are the ones right now who are telling states that they need to upgrade their driver's licenses. They're partially responsible for this new barcode thing on driver's licenses. So I can just see them drooling from the mouth at this idea of a national ID card.
Right. They would become more powerful. And any group out there wants to become more powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're more powerful, that usually can mean that you can demand more, you can get more money and all these other
things.
Name
the game.
So anyway, that's definitely their angle on it. And we have one of Peterman's favorite columnists, Alan.
This is like the all-time worst guy in the history of the world.
What? I thought last night you were saying he was your favorite.
No, this guy...
Don't you read him daily?
No, I hate this guy. The only time I read his articles are when I feel like puking or I want to feel good about myself.
And it's Alan Dershowitz?
Yes.
Peter Mann's favorite. Remember
Alan Dershowitz.
Peter Mann's favorite.
No.
Okay.
Here's a quote from him. And it sums up his weird views. Four Arab-looking guys reading the Quran are much less suspicious if they have the cards, referring to national ID cards, and can just slash them through the readers. Yes, they're just much less suspicious if they have cards that they can slide through the readers. Because,
well, as we were pointing out earlier, how hard is it going to be to forge these things?
Well, as we were pointing out earlier, how many of them could get legitimate cards from the government?
Right. Well, the
question, they're not wanting for anything.
I'm sort of curious, when they say slash them through the readers, are they going to hold the card in their hand and slide it through? And if that's the case, they could have a hotel card that's been doctored up.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a little Polaroid picture taped on front or something like that.
Yeah,
I put it through wash. It's not very good shape anymore, but I put it through the wash on accident. You know, And then also Alan has to say, there's a question of the right to anonymity. I don't believe we can afford to recognize such a right in this age of terrorism.
That we don't deserve anonymity?
Hello?
Privacy? Personal
Hello?
Privacy?
If he doesn't like the privacy he has, I suggest England. He would
oh,
be
yeah.
very...
He'd fit in real well.
Yeah, he'd be able to be on TV all the time.
Yeah.
Close circuit. Exactly.
Close circuit television all the time. In England, they're trying to get that satellite thing where they'll charge you depending on how many miles you drive your car.
Right.
Monitored by GPS. I mean, this is the kind of thing that Alan Dershowitz would love.
And then there's also the idea that anyone who had the card could be allowed to pass through airports and buildings security much more expeditiously. And anyone who opted out could be examined much more
yes,
closely.
Because, you know...
If you opt out, it's not because you have nothing to hide. It's because you're evil.
Yes. If I opt out, it's not because I like my liberty. I'm standing up for my rights as an American citizen. No, it's because I have something to hide from our federal government, or so Alan Dershowitz thinks. But, you know, like he said earlier about the slashing the card making us all safer, it's just ludicrous in the extreme to think that makes us safer. I mean, all of the terrorists, or at least 23 of the terrorists, were not wanted for any previous offense by the United States. So, as I've been stressing the whole program, what is to keep them from getting a real national ID card from the government? Because they're not known as terrorists until after they do something, not before. And that's the big thing there. People seem to think that you're just born a terrorist, and it's automatically labeled because it's who you are. Not so. You become a terrorist, and you're not really labeled that until after you've done something that's considered a terrorist act. You know, like I said, at least 9 of the terrorists had real Virginia State driver's licenses. It's just ludicrous. And Alan Dershowitz is just one of those people for power. He wants more power. As a government official, he wants the government to have more power because that gives him more power.
Well, yeah. Well, and so Alan Dershowitz has his little
yeah.
spin on it. Plus, I think just the fact that he's a socialist.
Well, yeah.
And he wants to see the American government system move towards what his ideology is. And if it does, then he has gained by being in a system that he prefers to be in.
He's a total socialist. Listen to this. Direct quote. From a civil liberties perspective, I prefer a system that takes a little bit of freedom from all to one, from all, to one that takes a great deal of freedom and dignity from the few, especially since those few are usually from a racially or ethnically disfavored group. A national ID card would be much more effective in preventing terrorism than profiling millions of men simply because of their appearance. Now, he had to work the race issue in here, you know, and the equality. This is socialism in a nutshell. I prefer a system that takes a little bit of freedom from all to one that takes a great deal of freedom and dignity from the few, even though those few are the ones that are causing all the problems. You know, his thing about preventing a national ID card would be more effective in preventing terrorism than profiling. You know, 23 of the 25 most wanted people by the United States of America all fit this profile that I'm about to tell you.
Well, there's one thing you got to remember, though.
They're all men between the ages of 25 and 35, listed as having an olive complex,
with 15 of them having long beards and 20 of them having the name Muhammad. And all of them are from foreign countries. They're not naturalized citizens.
We got to keep those Canadians out of here, don't we?
Yeah. So, I mean, think about that. That's not exactly the...
No, I'm being serious. I hate Canadians. No, just kidding.
No. I'm talking about the description there.
Oh, that, oh, not just any foreign... Oh.
That description that I just gave, that profile, that evil word profile that I just gave, profiles all of the terrorists that have attacked the United States in the past 10 years. You know, go back to the first World Trade Center bombing. The terrorists fit the description.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not some vague description like men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty specific.
Well, your profile would have been pretty close on on Oklahoma City if they had gotten away from the olive complexion, long beard thing and named Muhammad. Therefore, they ought to make their profile male between 25 and 35, and they would have stopped that one too.
Well, yeah, and that's probably legal to do that. But if you try to get specific and actually address the problem, then that's called racial profiling, and that's bad. And mm-hmm. Alan Dershowitz feels the same way, absolutely. But, you know, these asinine practices and thoughts about how a national ID card makes us all safer it's beyond my comprehension how someone could even think that. And the only reason Alan Dershowitz thinks that is because he's vying for power and he likes communism.
Right.
It's not because he actually believes what he's saying.
Right. He's a watermelon.
Yes.
No, just kidding.
No, go ahead.
There's a little side that we'll get to in a few minutes if you want to understand what that joke was all about. Peter Mann got it, but we'll talk a little bit about Earth Day here in a moment, and then you'll get the joke a little bit better. Okay, continuing on, it was interesting. I was down in I was actually over in Renton at Costco, and I was looking in the section with the books and whatnot and looking through that area, and I overheard two guys talking about the national ID card, and, you know, that perked my interest, of course,
yeah.
And one of them's like, oh, yeah, I don't really care. All my stuff's in a database anyway. Why not have them now?
And I'm like, gosh.
Yeah, that's the same kind of argument that other people are giving. Well, it's all there anyway. Might as well do it.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss.
Yes, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't understand what's going on, so let's just do it. Yeah.
I guess, you know, to conclude this, we'll go on a couple final thoughts here. And once again, if you have any comments or thoughts or suggestions, you can give us a call at 509-335-2207 or reach us at our website, www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com/PES, as in the Peter Eichmann Show. And
well,
remember, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I have just two quick things, and then you can close
this. Sure.
Because this is like pretty much does sum up my thoughts. And fear of the government, which fears your anonymity, which is sort of what the whole theme of this has been. And as I said earlier, or alluded to earlier, the inverse of liberty and freedom is slavery and control.
That's very, very
true. Not willing to fight for your freedom and stand up for your liberty and freedom, you will become slaves and you will be controlled. It's that simple.
And our final quote will be from Sam McDonald in his article, Uncle Sam Has All Your Numbers. Don't be fooled into debating the issue of, quote, privacy. Protecting privacy is not the issue. Blackmail artists will protect your privacy as long as you comply with their demands. The government is no different. The focus of the debate must be on liberty and freedom. The question must be, does the government have any right whatsoever to maintain databases of information about free citizens? The answer is simply no, not in a free society.
That's, I'm speechless. That just is perfect.
Enough said.
Yes.
You are listening to KZUU in the wonderful sounds of the jazz group Chicago Underground Duo, from their album Axis and Alignment.
It's interesting.
Interesting. We have a couple articles. Not, like we said, not a lot of tech stuff going on out there, so we'll touch on a few other issues.
Yeah.
And
hope you find them just as interesting.
Hope. Yeah, well, they're not tech-related. They're political. But
yeah.
they'll do for this week. And then we also have a...
Nothing wrong with political stuff.
Nothing wrong with political stuff. And I guess we'll go ahead and...
Jump in.
Jump into it, so to speak. A 72-year-old mystery is now solved.
Wow.
Yes. Lake Crescent. The mysterious Lake Crescent gave up one of its many secret Saturdays, apparently. And thank you for whistling.
No problem.
People's ears are going to be busting out. Anyway. Apparently ending a 72-year-old case of a missing couple. Volunteer divers and National Park Service search team believe they spotted a car 166 feet below the surface. Is a 1927 Chevrolet driven by Russell and Blanche Warren when they disappeared July 3rd, 1929. They say the car is remarkably intact, resting on its left side, tilting downward on a steep slope. It's only about 60 feet from the shore near Ambulance Point on U.S. Route 101, about 4 miles west from the west end of the 10-mile-long lake. Investigators believe the Warrens missed a curve before their car hurtled down a narrow dirt road, then the westbound car apparently hit a diagonal shelf in the water, causing it to spin clockwise before it stopped, pointing back east. It is near mile marker 223. The highway is now elevated and has guardrails, unlike in the Warrens' time. No human remains or traces were found in or around the car, but its location is consistent with debris trail that divers have found over the past 5 months. The discovery brings some peace and closure to the family of Russell and Blanche Warren, who lived on a logging camp west of Forks. Their two sons, then 12 and 14, were devastated by the disappearance and faced painful rumors about their parents abandoning them. Well, unfortunately... Here's the sad part of that whole entire thing. Both of the boys died well before they learned of their parents'.
Yeah.
Charles Warren, the father of Raleigh Warren, died at the age of 47.
Wow.
In a fishing boat accident in Northern California in 1964. And his older brother, Frank, died in Maple Valley in 1972 at the age of 57 of pulmonary congestion and edema from acute alcoholism. So in both situations, the boys never knew what happened to their parents. It's sort of
unfortunate.
It's unfortunate.
At least the family's finally getting closure because they know what's happened now, or they at least know where they're at. They can have a proper funeral.
Well, they don't have the body still, so I guess there's always a chance they were abandoned, but that's doubtful.
Yeah.
It's very doubtful. Okay. We got 37 more seconds of this. I think we'll slowly fade it away and... Talk about...
I like the X-Files.
I know.
They only have 5 episodes left.
I know. Isn't that terrible?
Yeah, actually, it is.
Okay. Well, I'll let you continue to believe it's terrible. I don't.
You don't like the X-Files?
I like the X-Files, but I haven't liked them the last few years. Certain episodes were really good. Certain themes they got on for a while were sort of...
I don't know. I really liked them when they still had the original characters, but... After going through so many seasons with Mulder and Scully, it was hard to adjust to the new agents.
Yeah. And it was sort of weird because then Scully went through the transformation where she was sort of the believer, and then Doggett was the non-believer.
Yeah.
And that was
kind of weird, too. I was like, Scully is always the scientific one.
And that's the thing. Is Scully always had these scientific things. Doggett was just like, that couldn't happen. You know, his explanation for what it really could be got old after about the first time because, that couldn't happen.
The original characters had better interplay.
Yeah.
Much better. Because Mulder would give something that was interesting, at least, and he would offer an explanation.
Yeah.
But that's off topic. Anyways.
Okay. Anyway, getting back to some other stuff, the Seattle school boards used to have a policy of busing students all over the place. And Peter Mann will have a story for that in a minute.
Yeah.
And a couple of years back, the great state of Washington voters voted in Initiative 200, which ended any race-based hiring or other practices done by the government. And because of that, a parents group had sued the Seattle schools saying that their policy of choosing what school a person goes to due to their race violated Initiative 200. And the Ninth District Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit District
yeah,
Court,
Ninth
of
Circuit
Appeals,
Court of Appeals,
upheld or, you know, overturned, I guess, Seattle's policy that had been in effect for years. And essentially, the Seattle School District will most likely drop its race-based tiebreaker for the 2002-2003 school year while it waits for the results of its appeal, and will need to recalculate some 9,000 assignments
for
incoming kindergarten, sixth, and ninth graders.
9,000 people were put in school based on their race.
Race. But we want to be a colorblind society.
Yeah.
Remember that.
Go
figure.
That's
the important thing. Okay, the race-based tiebreaker was one of four ways the district determined what students got into what schools, and some schools were highly demanded due to the some schools are better than other schools, and those went in high demand had a everybody wanted to go there. So what they would do is they'd look at four issues. One was whether a brother or a sister attended that school. One was the student race, and it would be a factor when the race in that school is considered unbalanced, and that is if more than 55% or less than 25% of the students were white, then the student's race would be brought into focus, and the district-wide average is 40% white.
Well,
other tiebreakers were how far the student lived from the school and a lottery. This issue seems complex to Sunny Terry, a African-American woman whose five sons attend district schools. I don't want my children to in school to meet a quota. That's when they become tokens. I don't want them in that school if that's the only reason why they're there. However, Terry said, she, like any other parent, wants the best for her sons. Jill Kerfurst, one of the parents behind the lawsuit, said she disagrees with the notion that schools will become more racially segregated because of the court's decision. The schools already have a rich mix of ethnicities, she said. It's just the district policy only acknowledges diversity as a difference between white and non-white.
And that is an excellent point right there.
Right.
You know, we're trying to be colorblind, we're trying to be all this, we're trying to make up for reparations and everything, and yet, if you're white, then you're white, and if you're non-white, then you're diverse.
Well, I mean,
how does that work?
Well, the whole entire mixture composition of a school was, if the school was too white or not white enough, then we had to add more or get away with some. Other than that, it didn't matter. So so as far as the other racial diversity went, as far as the other races, it didn't matter. So it's sort of interesting
It doesn't even really seem to fulfill a policy goal or role or have any sort of purpose. I mean, if it's just white or non-white, then you're not really promoting diversity. You're just promoting whites and non-white being in the same school. That's all. I mean, if you want to promote diversity, if that was their whole goal, then they should have had quotas of how many of each race should be in the school. But they didn't do that because every school already has a good mixture of races and natural diversity. I don't even like the word, but it just naturally is like that. And this policy just seems stupid. I can tell you from experience that when I was in first grade for about 6 months in Seattle, I was bused for about three and a half to four hours every morning to school. And this wasn't because there was this long, complicated, zigzagging bus route. Most of the time was spent on freeways because we were going across, it seemed like across the state to a little kid, but I just remember my parents were so upset that I got bused across the district on a four-hour bus ride when I lived two blocks or two and a half blocks from a school. And it was the stupidest thing, and it was all because of race. You know, I could have gone to the school that was two blocks away if I'd had some American Indian in me, or more American Indian in me. But since I didn't, I had to be bused across the district. And that was just the stupidest thing in the world. When they finally did away with that, I was overjoyed because in fourth grade, for a couple months, when I was in Seattle again, I was going to school there, I got to go to the school that was only two blocks away from me. And I can tell you that was a lot nicer. And the school was not a predominantly white school just because they got rid of that stupid law. No, it wasn't. It was a diverse school still. Had lots of every kind of race there. But I didn't have to have a four-hour bus ride. That was the point. I mean, that's just stupid. And to base where people go on race seems stupid, too, like Scott said. Scooter over there. We're trying to be a colorblind society of getting rid of all semblance of skin color just based on merits. And we're having 9,000 people in the Seattle school districts bust around the district because schools don't have enough, quote-unquote, diversity, meaning white or non-white. That's just, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I'm glad that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as liberal as they usually are, threw out the lawsuit. I'm very pleased with that.
I'm very pleased with it too, Peter, man. And I think that the voters of the state of Washington got it right when they decided that Initiative 200 needed to pass.
Yeah.
And I think they got it right, the Ninth Circuit District Court of Appeals got it right when they said, you know, the people of the state of Washington are correct.
Yeah.
We need to have this law in place. Was there any tech issues that you did want to bring up?
No, not really for me. I mean, everything seems to be just blah on tech, like you said.
Right.
It's either stuff we've already talked about or just new articles, new words, same articles
right.
about stuff we've already talked about.
Okay. If that's the case, everybody's been holding on, hopefully, for this watermelon reference, and here we go. Today, as some people know, is Lenin's birthday.
Yes.
And by no coincidence, it's Earth Day.
By no coincidence? What are you talking about?
There is no coincidence that Earth Day was put on Lenin's birthday.
Are you trying to infer that people who support Earth Day are communists?
The people who started it.
Oh, okay.
Not necessarily those who support it now, but those who started it. So you got it. When you look at it, you know, how much sense does it make to have Earth Day in the middle of a week or at the beginning of the week or something? I mean, usually something like that would be great to have on a weekend where people could go out and actually do things for Earth Day, like, you know, plant a tree or, you know, clean up a park or something like that, I guess. But to have it, you know, on a Monday when everybody's at work or other days, it's like, you know, why didn't the initial people who put this together go, you know, how about like the first Saturday in the month of April or something like that where it was always going to be the same.
No,
it was always going to be on a weekend.
The 22nd.
It was the 22nd
of April.
Because it's Lenin's birthday. And where the watermelon reference comes in is because they're green on the outside, pink on the
inside. Yep.
I actually didn't come up with that myself. I heard that on the radio and I thought that was sort of humorous.
It is.
I suppose for some it's not, but hey. That's,
well, if you're the green one, then you're probably just in denial.
Anyway, got a couple more preview tracks, and we will come back with...
we're going to have a update of last week's story or discussion about the
flag burning
at the U of I and the senators and all the resignations that have been flying left and right.
Well, you just told them. That's not an update anymore. We'll skip that, and we'll just go straight with the other article now. See you later.
What, last week we talked about all the resignations.
Again, thank you for listening to the Peter Eichmann Show, broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower on the third floor of the Cub. This is Scooter.
And this is Peter.
And you are listening to KZUU 90.7. You can reach us on the telephone at 509-335-2207 and on the web at www.informationtechnologyprofessional.com/PES is in the Peter Eichmann Show, and you can get our message board at www.witsybanter.com. And in the final hour, we will talk about that shooting that happened over in the Renton area. If you are looking to get the word out about your club and you're having a hard time doing so, KZUU can help. KZUU offers public service and outlets free of charge to people just like you who are looking to get the word out. Come fill out a form every day, available every day outside the Cub Room 311. Do you need last-minute community service hours for your service learning class? Do you want to get out and help some community members? If so, the Service for Seniors program at the Community Service Learning Center has a number of service projects available that might interest you. Service for Seniors is looking for students to help senior citizens with yard work and other chore projects. Many projects involve 3 to 4 hour commitments. Groups and individuals are encouraged to sign up. If you're staying for summer school, why not make some new friends while you're here? Services for Seniors is also seeking students for long-term chores and companion assistance for the summer. For more information or how to get involved in these services, service learning projects, or others, please call Service for Seniors at 335-0578. KZUU is now accepting summer applications. If you are interested in being an on-air personality here at KZUU, come by the Cub, Room 311, or go online at www.kzuu.com. Excuse me, kzuu.org. We hire a wide variety of people and would like to hear from you, so come on and jump aboard the KZUU bandwagon. The views expressed by those on the Peter Eichmann Show, or those of the Peter Eichmann Show, Scooter and Peter, and they do not necessarily reflect that of KZUU, its affiliates, its managers, or anybody associated with Washington State University or the Compton Union Building. We are afforded this opportunity to do our freedom of speech First Right Amendment stuff. And should you want to exercise yours, give us a call at 335-2207. Peter and I are always looking for a good, open, honest debate.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Well, for the...
What we have coming up now is our deputy shooting thing over in Renton. And let me give you a sort of a background on what had happened. This all happened April 7th, which was a Sunday. An off-duty King County deputy sheriff was checking out the report of a suspicious vehicle parked near his house and ended up shooting and killing the driver after that driver pointed a gun at him. Around 11:30 a.m., a resident noticed a truck parked in the Maple Hill subdivision east of Renton and rural King County. The resident thought the driver and his two passengers were acting suspiciously and called the deputy, who was a neighbor. Deputy got his gun and, in plain clothes, walked to the maroon Chevy pickup. I heard 3 gunshots consecutively. Boom, boom, boom. Miss Marissa Alexander, who was watching television, she ran outside and saw her neighbor, Donnie Gilmore, who had been doing yard work. The deputy told Gilmore to call 911. He gave him his badge number and told Gilmore to tell the operator that at least one armed suspect, Alexander, heard some moaning inside the truck. Within minutes, backup police cruisers were at the scene, and officers converged on the truck. The driver died at the scene. One passenger, a 39-year-old man from the Renton area, was shot in the hand and taken to Harborview Medical Center. He was in satisfactory condition last night. The second passenger, a 40-year-old woman, walked out of the truck with her hands up after the driver was shot and then fell face forward, according to witnesses. She was not injured. Police interviewed her yesterday but released no details about her account. The deputy, a patrol officer with more than 20 years law enforcement experience, was not injured. Police did not release his name, but neighbors identified him as Mel Miller. The deputy, who works in the Maple Valley precinct, was placed on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Details of the shooting, which occurred on the 14500 block of 196th Avenue South, were sketchy. Demersky said he did not know whether the driver was fired upon. He did not know the number of shots fired or the sequence of events. He did not know what the people were doing in the truck in the first place. That goes along with this article, which I think more or less got the crux of the issue across. There was some sort of, well, the initial part of it. There's some sort of there's some sort of something going on. The deputy went up there as I guess you could almost say Joe Blow citizen.
Yeah.
He didn't go up in uniform or anything, and shots were fired. Didn't say exactly what took place inside the vehicle or anything like that. When you're all done reading that and everything, I mean, I suppose after reading that account of it, you don't really know what took place to make the shots be fired, but all you know is that there's a guy who was a deputy, and then there's people inside the truck. They pulled a gun. He fired back. One of them died. One of them got injured. Okay? Seems like a cut and dry case. Well, no. Not that easy. Ever since then, this has exploded. What's interesting about it is, it's almost like, first off, there's a reverend over there who's trying to make a name for himself, I think. He's taking every opportunity to become maybe the next Al Sharpton.
Or Jesse Jackson.
Or Jesse Jackson. He seems to be soaking up the rays of publicity that he's getting by doing several things, which we'll get into in a little while.
Seems to be a little full of himself.
He, unfortunately... I think he's taking the wrong cause. I'm sure there are other causes out there he could pick up and get community support behind. But in a situation where a man is shot after pointing a gun at somebody else, I don't see how you can turn it into an issue that they're trying to turn it into. Well, here is the thing. Until now, you didn't know this, but here you'll know it. The officer was white. The guy who died was black.
Black.
And
this is a racial article issue.
At the very end, the very last paragraph made light of that. Now, after that, throughout many other articles, race, though, ought not to be a... I don't think this ever was a racial issue, but it seems to be turning into one, and that's where the Reverend is coming in. He seems to be one of the ones championing this as a racial issue more than a lot of other people. And the attorney for the shooting, the shootees, I guess you could say, they call them victims in here, but I don't necessarily think they're victims.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, if
they're I guess they're a victim of a gunshot wound, but they're not victims of the situation.
No, not at all. And they should be more clear when they say victim, because I think that they're trying to get across that they're victims of a shooting, period, like because they were black. And it's not the case.
And anyway, their attorney says this is not a case about race. It's about people being killed. That's the only person I think that made any sense in what he tried to say. The protesters marched on Interstate 5, plugged up the southbound rush hour traffic for almost an hour yesterday, and this was on the 16th, which was a Tuesday. This was just one of several quote-unquote surprise strategic attacks aiming at changing the way law enforcement views black men, African-American leaders said. Okay, that's weird. This is just the inauguration, the beginning of a sustained effort to get responses we've been seeking, said Reverend Leslie Braxton. And this is the senior pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church. He is the one who is trying to make himself the next well-known reverend out there by taking up these causes. And like I said, in this case, I think he's taking up a cause that he would be better taking up other causes, because this one, to me, seems like a losing case. Yes, it was a white cop. Yes, it was a black man that got killed. But I think that's just a coincidence in the whole situation of somebody pulling a gun on somebody else.
I don't even see how this can be justified as a cause. I mean, he's just making something out of nothing.
We will continue this behavior until until there are substantive changes. What you saw yesterday is an example of what we're talking about. Several hundred people packed into Mount Zion to say their farewells. After the service, most of them walked from the church down Madison Street, heading towards King County Courthouse for a rally. At least that's the plan that was given to the Seattle PD. So not only did they lie to the cops, they went on to I-5 and outfit, but the leaders unexpectedly led the crowd onto I-5 on a ramp near Madison Street, although some of the marchers stayed off the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
Motorcycle police rushed to swerve in front of those going on the freeway to prevent them from being hit by cars. Several were almost hit by cars.
Yeah, I don't...
makes you almost go, well, maybe they should have been hit. Anybody who's going to walk onto a freeway...
That doesn't make much
55
sense.
55-mile-an-hour, I mean, that 2,000-pound object hurling down towards you. I'm not going to get near it.
You think about what's happened here up to now of what we've said, and you have this Blackwell. He's trying to make this big issue out of nothing. You know, he's trying to make this seem like a racial issue when it's not. And to further that, he's trying to say that, well, the police are against all of his race. And that's ridiculous. You know, the police set up a route for them. I mean, they approved a route for them.
Mm-hmm.
They put out roadblocks and blocked off traffic so that these people could march and have their rally and exercise their First Amendment right to the freedom of speech. No matter how much I think that they're wrong, that was their right. But then they broke the law. They went onto a freeway endangering their lives and the lives of the motorists and the cops that were trying to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped traffic. They made people late for their appointments for work. They could have potentially cost companies hundreds of thousands of dollars from people being late. You have travelers that aren't even part of the state or know what's happened that are being held up because now you're on an interstate, so you have people from all over. I mean, that should not be tolerated. You can...
But it was, because nobody got arrested.
I know, that's the thing. And the reason it was tolerated... Because the police don't want to be seen as taking actions against people who are trying to promote racially sound policies or something. But it's ridiculous. When you break the law, you should go to jail. It doesn't matter what race you are.
But Miller, or Braxton, does say something here that I sort of agree with. He goes, the Reverend Les, he says that he believes Thomas had every right to be where he was. And I agree, Thomas did have every right to be where he was.
Yep.
And he also goes on to say he was doing nothing illegal when Miller shot him. Now, that's up for debate. If he pointed a gun at Miller, he did something illegal.
Yeah.
At the time, he was in possession of a stolen firearm. That is illegal. And in one of the articles, one of the later articles, after a search was done of the truck, they found a bottle of Cisco wine, I believe it was,
mm-hmm.
and drug paraphernalia. And being in possession of drug paraphernalia is illegal.
Legal also.
So technically he was doing illegal actions at the time of the shooting. But in possession of a stolen gun and in possession of drug paraphernalia, in of itself is not an offense that you should be shot over. I agree with that.
I agree
However,
with that too.
You point a gun at somebody, they have a gun, they point it back and shoot, too bad. Too sad.
Yeah, because when you point a gun at someone, that gets the message across that you're going to shoot them.
It doesn't matter if it's a fake gun, because the person who's being pointed at doesn't know.
Doesn't
matter if it's unloaded or loaded. As a matter of fact, in the state of Washington, you point an unloaded gun at another person, that's assault in the second degree. That's a Class B felony. That is big time. Loaded or unloaded, because it's perceived. The person on the other end doesn't know whether it's loaded or not loaded.
That's the thing.
So the thing is that by pointing the gun at somebody, he immediately committed a Class B felony. Okay. We are concerned that people acting within their constitutional rights in their community can get killed, Braxton said. Once again, he was within his constitutional right to be there, but he went outside of his constitutional rights to point a gun at somebody. Yesterday, Braxton of Mount Zion Baptist Church said he considers race a secondary factor in the Elder Thomas's death. I think the sight of a black person can heighten the fear, especially in white people, said Braxton. Miller is white and Thomas is
black. Where does he get off with statements like that? I think the presence of a black person can heighten fear in white people or whatever. Well, I mean,
that's
how does he get off
that's
saying
how it
that?
Becomes, well, that's how it becomes a racial issue.
Yeah, he's making stuff up. I mean, he's not even going off of facts there. He's just blatantly making up stuff so that he can get media publicity.
Okay. And the three, two black men and one white woman, were on their way to have breakfast with a friend who had moved into a mostly white neighborhood near Renton. Okay, so we're making, once again, a big issue about race right there in that one. Here's another one. Thomas Jr., the son of the man who was shot and killed. I thought he was just a nice white guy who was coming up to help us. Okay, and that's why a gun was needed to be pulled out on him. Okay, and also, two black men and a white woman in the back of a truck, said Tuttle, who was white. They had the audacity to be black in a lily white neighborhood. And this is Colleen Tuttle, who is the man who was shot his girlfriend, who said that. So, you know what I mean? It's like everybody...
That's why they were shot, because they had the audacity to be black in a lily white neighborhood.
Yeah, lily white neighborhood.
Yep.
You know, it's just...
No, he was shot because he pulled a firearm on someone who also had a firearm. And the other person happened to be faster and a better shot.
Yep.
That's all there was to it. I mean, if a normal citizen, you know, had the gun... and it was going up to offer the people instructions or ask them to get out of the road, and he'd pulled a gun on them, they would have shot him too, and it still would have been just as legal, since it's ruled as self-defense as it is now. They wouldn't have had to identify themselves as a police officer, because they were a normal citizen, not an issue, self-defense. If the officer had been black, the same thing would have happened. If the person shot had been white, the same thing still would have happened, but not according to Braxton.
Thomas Sr. Would never point a gun at someone unless he feared for his life, his family said. This was a quote from Thomas Jr. He said his dad would never point a gun at somebody unless he feared for his life. Well, let's go back to a few things here.
He must easily fear for his life, according to what you're about to...
He was involved in a police shootout in 1972 and was convicted of a firearms-related crime in 1981 and another in 84. In 1972, he pled guilty to second-degree assault after a shootout with an officer who was trying to arrest him for drunken driving. That seems like a reason to pull a gun on somebody.
Yeah, I was afraid for my life because I was going to be arrested for a DUI.
Yep. 1981, another tangle with the law. Thomas made threats to kill his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend, according to the court documents. Police staked out the house, and when Thomas arrived, he was arrested, and he was carrying a knife and a gun. He was convicted of a felon being in possession of a handgun and sentenced to 90 days in work release. And 2 years later, Thomas lost a bet with another man at a bar. The two scuffled, but Thomas left. When he returned, he approached a man and a woman who gave him a handgun. According to the court records, he then shot the man in the right shoulder, saying, "You come any closer and I'll kill you deader than hell." So, once again, let me read this other quote. Thomas Sr. would never point a gun at someone unless he feared for his life.
Yeah, except, you know, he loses a bet, he leaves a bar, and then he comes back and
shoots
a guy.
He loses a bet, gets in a fight, he left, therefore how could he be in fear for his life? And then he comes back and he shoots somebody.
Yeah.
Okay, he gets arrested for a DUI. He feared for his life again.
And so he has a shootout with the cops. It doesn't make any sense to me at all that he would only pull a gun if he feared for his life.
Well, also, you have the situation where...
but then again...
The cop in this whole scenario is a 19-year veteran on the King County... Well, both with King County and the Tukwila Police Departments. 19 years... And it took him this long to get in a shooting with a black guy, if that's what the whole issue was?
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, from my reading of this, they're saying that Miller pulled the trigger because Thomas was black.
Mm-hmm.
Which means Miller was out to shoot somebody, especially because they're black.
Or that
he was more willing to shoot him because he's black. In 19 years, don't you think he's dealt with at least one other black man?
Yeah, I would think somewhere in his career he would have dealt
with many.
He didn't
shoot them. I don't think Miller was out to shoot a black man that day.
I mean, I don't think he was out to shoot anybody.
I agree.
Ask him why they were blocking the road. Their vehicle was partially obstructing the road, and, you know, a state patrol, a neighbor, a normal deputy, Miller in this case, anybody would go up and ask him, "Why are you blocking the road? Could you please move?"
Well, I know the road, that area, and it's a relatively narrow two-lane road with very small shoulders and relatively deep ditches. and it's very hilly, very windy. And to block part of the road is not a very safe situation at all.
And they posed a traffic hazard. He was asking them to move. And as any neighbor would do, he's asking them to move and if they were lost or something, since they were just parked there blocking the road. It seemed to make sense. Went up to him, and Thomas Sr. pulled a gun on him. And it just happened to be that since this was a police officer, he was armed, he was a quicker draw, and he shot the guy. It's tragic that Thomas Sr. died, but when you pull a gun on somebody, you're conveying the intent to shoot and kill. And the police officer responded in kind. You know, it's tragic that it happened, but it's nothing that's racially based, and it's nothing that the police officer should be punished for or anything. It's just another guy who wants to become Jesse Jackson, who's trying to make this into a race-based issue.
Right. And one of the issues that people keep bringing up in this whole entire deal is, did he identify himself as a police officer? And I keep arguing that it doesn't matter whether he said he was a cop or not. Dwayne Fish, a Seattle police spokesman, said that it shouldn't matter whether Miller identified himself as an officer. A civilian with a legal pistol should or could shoot someone who pointed a gun at them. And there isn't a prosecutor on this planet who's going to prosecute somebody for protecting their own life. I want the same right afforded to police officers.
That's very true. I mean, they shouldn't have to identify themselves when it's self-defense. It shouldn't make any difference whether they did or not, because, as you just said, if a normal citizen had been carrying a gun with a concealed carry permit, and he'd fired, and the same consequences would have happened, or the same situation would have evolved, Thomas Sr. would have been killed, there would be none of this. There would be nothing. Did he identify himself? You know, they'd probably still be trying to push the racial thing, because it seems to be popular nowadays. Good way to get media attention and followers. But you don't have to identify yourself to defend yourself.
Nope. You pull a gun on me, you better hope that you're going to be shooting as soon as it pulled. Okay, the FBI is now going to do an inquiry into the shooting. But, as they're saying, this is not unusual. They say that the FBI, them doing an investigation, an initial investigation, is commonplace and rarely results in a federal prosecution. Nationwide, the FBI conducts between 5,000 and 6,000 preliminary inquiries each year, with fewer than 1,000 leading to a full investigation. So this is something that's pretty normal or average for it to happen. However, once again, Braxton is looking for followers, trying to show that he's the man, is happy about the FBI's involvement in the investigation. And he believes that their involvement is directly related to his incident of stopping the traffic on I-5. So it's because of him that the FBI became involved.
Yeah, I don't think so. Somebody needs to walk up to this guy and tap him on the head, bring him back to reality, and explain to him that this is not racially based. This was purely self-defense. His congestion that he caused on I-5 did nothing except make people angry, late for work, cost them money, and if it did anything, it hurt his cause because now people are relating their anger to his cause.
Right. And he's happy about that. He's saying, we already are seeing the fruits of our determination. And according to many African Americans, the only acceptable outcome of an FBI inquiry into the shooting would be for Deputy Miller to be fired. That's the only acceptable outcome.
And that's just ridiculous.
Let me get this straight. So if the outcome is that Thomas pulled the gun first, tried to shoot him, all these other things, it's still the only acceptable outcome
fired? It's a pre-gone conclusion, foregone conclusion that Miller killed Thomas Sr.
because he was black.
Because he was black. Because they had the audacity to be black in a lily white neighborhood. That is why he's dead right now. And that's a foregone conclusion.
Yes. And we will come back
We have letters to the editor. These get good, so stay tuned.
Welcome back. One other thing to pass along real fast here is, let me do a quick PSA first, and then we will go into more of that. Having trouble getting the word out about your club or event? Well, KZUU can help. KZUU offers public service announcements free of charge to people just like you who are looking to get the word out. Come fill out our form available every day outside Cub 311. Thanks. Okay. Once again, the views expressed on the Peter Eichmann Show are those of Peter and Scooter and do not represent or reflect the opinions of the management or the staff at KZUU, the directors, Washington State University, or any other entity therein. They're just
that
Peter
pretty
and
much
and
doesn't.
I. Okay. According to Robert Lee Thomas Jr., the son of the man who was shot, here's how it happened. this is how it happened. And just
yeah,
so you
I like
know,
this.
I need you to know this because you might find yourself in a similar kind of situation, and you need to know what could happen if you don't follow the rules. He came out in a white jumpsuit, and he said, "Move the truck now! Move it now!" And then it was pop, pop, pop. We didn't move the truck in time. Obviously, if you don't park properly, you're going to get shot and killed.
According to him.
Remember that now. So when you're up on Greek Row, and you can't find a place to park, and you go on the sidewalk, cop's going to come up and shoot you.
Only if you're black.
Only if you're black.
According to Thomas there.
According to, yes.
Thomas Jr.
That's true. That's right. I forgot to add that part in.
Yeah. Because this is a racially based killing. We all know
this
that.
This was. And the cops will, going on with some letters to the editor. These
we
are.
Know, somewhere, then his account, he was like, I just asked him, I just saw this nice white guy, as we said earlier. And then he goes on, I just asked him, hi, who are you? What's your name? What's your name? What's your name? And then it was pop, pop, pop. And that was
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So anyway, it was somewhere between asking him what his name was and him telling him to move the truck that they got shot and killed. Maybe it's you can't ask the cop's name and disregard. Well, you can't ask this person's name and disregard orders at the same time.
Yeah, that's what did it.
I'll get you shot.
Just drove him over the edge.
Yep. Okay. These are a couple letters to the editor. I thought they were sort of interesting.
Or sickening, depending which ones you read.
Yeah, they're from both sides of the spectrum. Everybody's sort of putting in their two cents, and I think, giving the opportunity for all these to be put out there might be sort of fun.
That's a good thing.
Okay, this is from Martin Smith of Redmond. To those who are upset because they lost a few minutes in traffic, get over it. Sorry to make people uncomfortable, but guess what? Now you know how many in this community feel. This is called understanding. If it makes you angry or upset or feel like, why me? I'm just trying to live my life. Now you know how we feel. If it were a dead deer or a dog in the road, people would have been sad. If it were just another dose of this region's awful traffic, people would have put on another CD or used their cell phone to talk the time away. How truly sad to hear the whine of people who consider it a travesty to sit in a few extra minutes of traffic for a protest, but basically ignore the travesty that caused the protest in the first place, and that they do not change the status quo. Police stop traffic for us all along the route, all down Madison, not just on the freeway. People of all colors marched. Two women in front of me who walked 15 plus blocks in high heels.
As if that makes a difference that they can't choose proper shoes for a march.
Well, the message of the march I was in on Tuesday is that if it affects one, it affects all of us. United we stand. Remember? That 911 message is now conveniently forgotten by the people who are complaining, even though they move slowly in traffic for a whole half hour.
So that's just that whole thing sickens me, just going through how he sits there and he says, well, now you know how we feel. So he's basically saying that this is how we always felt. We hate what you're doing to us, and we're protesting it. And the way that we're going to protest it is to do what we hate so much to you. Now, that doesn't make any sense to me, but, you know, I didn't write the letter either. I mean, that okay. seems illogical. I hate this so much, I'm going to do it to you. I mean, what's that supposed to be about? I mean, if we use that, if we use his theory there all throughout history, the Holocaust, after that, since, I mean, it was something that we all hate, and it's written through history books as something that never to happen again, we would have just done that to Germany and decided, well, we hate it so much, we want you to know how we felt.
That's nothing wrong
that's
with that.
That's stupid.
Nobody likes Germans.
Nobody does that. That's stupid. If you hate something so much, you never want to see it again. You don't do it to other people. So, I mean, just the opening of his letter shows that there's no logic going on in his head there.
Okay. Dave Hamilton of Bellevue. Tuesday's march on the freeway and subsequent threats of future similar actions do nothing to further the goals of the family of Robert Lee Thomas Sr. or the minority community. Instead of feeling their rage of unfair treatment by police, it gave many of us the feeling of, quote-unquote, road rage. For a brief moment, many thousands of people acknowledged their power. The power to stop traffic is not real power. Anything that is so easy to get isn't valuable. That is the power of rage. It makes people do certain things that do not make sense. It is an intoxicant that gives temporary sense of power that is all too soon replaced by the sobering reality that things have just gotten worse. On the very day that Washington State Patrol swarmed I-5 emphasizing the destructiveness of the social ill of road rage, a group of so-called mourners chose to prove a point rather than honor the life of a father and a friend. A highway can handle so much rage at one time. It is difficult to identify with people who walk on the freeway. It is not difficult, however, to identify with people who have a struggle for power, who have been mistreated, or who have lost a parent or a friend. This community is more sensitive than many and certainly smart enough to look at the facts of the case and make reasoned judgments about its merits, if given the chance. So I was sort of in the middle, I think.
In the middle, yeah.
He's sort of saying, you know, I understand you guys have the struggle for power, but the way you went about it probably wasn't the best, mm-hmm. You know, there's other ways of showing your...
He's right. That's why, you know, the police had approved and sectioned off a route for them so that they could have their march and protest.
Yeah.
And that's the ways to go about it. Not blocking the freeway, because that goes back, you know, like I alluded to earlier, now you have all those people are connecting their anger with that cause. And that doesn't help the cause any. That just pisses people off. They're like, get out of my way. I don't care anymore.
Okay. This is from Judy Moyes, M-O-I-S-E, Moyes, I think, of Shoreline. Our most effective crime prevention tool is our partnership with residents like you. That's a quote from the King County Sheriff's Office Crime Prevention Handbook. How far does this partnership extend, and where is the accountability? The resident, quote, in parentheses, still anonymous, who called an armed off-duty deputy slash neighbor to investigate an unfamiliar parked car, and the deputy, Melvin Miller, who responded in his self-designated role as neighborhood protector, should at least accept the responsibility of handling this quote-unquote call improperly. What about the sheriff's office policy stating that, quote, off-duty department members shall not become involved, particularly in their own neighborhood, unless the situation could result in A, somebody being injured, or B, the loss of or damage of property. Is this open to overly broad interpretation leading to a kind of vigilantism? And if so, is this the protection we want for our neighborhoods? I guess the one major comment that I have about this is saying he responded in his self-designated role as neighborhood protector.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's not like he put up a sign in the front yard saying, hey, I'm a cop, give me a call if you need your neighborhood protected.
Well, that's, I mean...
I think a neighbor... Looking at the road and looking where the vehicle most likely was, it's going to be probably halfway into the roadway. And it's just sitting there. There sounds like there's arguing coming from the vehicle. Neighbor's like, ooh, something is going on here. I'm going to get a hold of a neighbor of mine who I know to be a police officer because, you know, maybe somebody should be alerted about this.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. The police officer was not indulging his vigilantism or his self-designated role as protector of the community. When you see something, when the truck was blocking the roadway and the arguments, like you just said, the neighbor was thinking, hey, something's going on. Maybe someone should go see what's happening. It could have been the neighbor, but then he thought, no, you know, I have a police officer who lives just down the street. He would be better to check this out because he's trained for this sort of thing. He's armed, and he'll have backup. So who should go out? Should it be me, Joe Blow, with no training, no defense, in case something tragic happens? Or should it be a police officer who's trained? Well, that's a hard decision for me. It's going to be the police officer every time. Okay. It wasn't him being a vigilante.
Okay. We have several more to go and not a whole bunch of time, so we'll try to speed through a few of these. And if we have any outstanding comments that we really need to make, we'll go ahead and do those and go from there. Okay, this is from David Silliman of Camano Island. When lawbreakers slash protesters are allowed to endanger citizens driving on I-5 and illegally delay them, create dire hazard, and the police department is not allowed to arrest these lawbreakers, we have lost all hope of ever defeating crime. Our kids see this as completely acceptable because of no police action was taken. When the involved citizens began their march, although I disagree with their assessment of the shooting, I support their and respect their right to protest and question the facts. When they commenced to block traffic, endanger themselves and others about them, they became criminally liable and should have been arrested and cited for their actions. If this is another incident of officers on the line not being allowed to perform their duties by inaction or appeasement of the hierarchy of the police department, let's replace the top and all those who refuse to perform or are incapable of performing their duty. I think that's a pretty good one there. Sort of hit the nail.
Yeah, bravo.
Jeff Simpson of Renton. When members of the community band together to march through the streets to bring attention to their agenda, misguided or not, it serves as a dramatic gesture. Street marches are dangerous, too. That's why the cooperation of the police is needed. The marches organized by the Reverend Leslie Baxton of the Mount Zion Church went too far when they blocked the freeway. They intentionally misled police about the route, and they intentionally walked through a police roadblock to access the freeway, thereby crippling a region, not just part of the city. Rather than allowing the march to conclude at the courthouse with the bus ride back to the church, courtesy of the city, the marchers should have been arrested on the freeway with a free bus ride straight to jail. Unfortunately, these lawless marchers probably will not be prosecuted due to the criminal justice system's willingness to bend over backwards to deflect charges of racism. In my view, failure to enforce the law in such situations like this has become the face of modern racism. Next one is from Nat Burgess of Seattle. In reference to the protesters who blocked Interstate 5 during rush hour traffic on Tuesday, the Times quoted Larry Gossett as saying, "Unfortunately, most of Seattle will wake up tomorrow and won't understand what this is all about." In the article, "Protest in which marchers enter I-5 called Strategic Strike," from April 17th. From the accounts in the newspaper, it appears that this is all about a man in a vehicle pointing a gun at someone and getting shot in response. Race and the fact the shooter was an off-duty deputy did not appear to drive the confrontation, nor its outcome. By taking the bold, disruptive step of delaying thousands of people who were trying to get home from work, the protesters certainly attracted attention. I sat in traffic. I read it in the paper. I saw it on the nightly news. But Gossick is correct. My delay in getting home definitely didn't change my understanding about what this is all about. That right there, I think, is so far the best one I've read. I think he hit the nail on the head when he said, simply, race and the fact the shooter was off-duty deputy did not appear to drive the confrontation nor its outcome.
I think his whole thing was just well-written, the whole thing.
That right there, though, I think that sentence right there, I think, could be the thesis of our whole entire hour.
Oh, yeah, it could have been.
This is Marion Ellie of Renton. I am saddened by the need for some members of the African-American community to create a traffic mess in order to make a point about racism by law enforcement. Of course, I do not know all the facts, only what I see on TV and read in the newspapers. I'd ridden the bus that day and had already arrived home when this occurred. If I'd been caught in the backup on I-5, I would have been very frustrated. And I hope that there is more positive way for the African American community to get their message across. My sense is that Tuesday's march on I-5 did not create very many sympathetic listeners and viewers. Threats about future quote unquote surprises won't either. This one is Chris Martin of Seattle. Tuesday night, I sat in front of my TV set watching the latest weirdness with mixed feelings. I understand the point of the protesters we're trying to get across. We absolutely must implement measures that protect both the citizens of King County and the law enforcement officers who put their life on the lines for our protection. It is time we stop talking about intolerance and racial equality and actually implement actions that will lead to those ideals. Regardless of the truth of their message, these protesters broke the law. They endangered innocent people and basically held the city hostage for an hour. And they are threatening more actions of this type. If you break the law, you should face the consequences, whether they are justified or you should be or not. You should be up to a judge and jury. Letting these protesters get out with these illegal actions is the same sort of racism that we should all be fighting against. Justice is, if not society, should be colorblind. I really don't have a problem with their message or even really the way they chose to get the message across, but they should be held accountable for their actions. The thing I have the problem with is they weren't. And this is from Marion Forey of Sammamish. There seems to be something missing in the coverage of the police-related incident in this town. When a police officer shoots an African-American, there is an outcry of protest that is heavily reported by the media. The black community labels the police department as racist and a picture is painted of the unequal justice. And my interpretation of what I read and see reported is that the black community feels that the simple fact that the victim is black is sufficient to render the police's action is improper. I don't know enough about the relationship between the police and the black community to agree or disagree that race-based bias exists. But one initial flurry of media coverage dies away, I never hear about the black community has to say on those occasions when the person shot turns out to be at fault. There has been times when the victim was totally whacked out on drugs and truly threatened the lives of the police officers who were trying to control him, and let alone innocent bystanders, or perhaps the victim didn't pull a gun on an officer responding, or perhaps the victim really did pull a gun on an officer responding to a called in complaint. Because I never hear what the black community has to say when police actions are showed to be justified, that leaves me to wonder if the black community thinks it should have a different standard of justice, one that should overlook criminal actions of if the perpetrator is black. I find it hard to believe that the law-abiding African-Americans should feel this way, but I don't see much in the media that would cause me to believe otherwise. Not reporting something can be just as divisive to our community as the inflammatory reporting. So how about giving us as much reporting weight to the black community reaction after the investigation as given to the reaction before the investigation? And this next one is from Kenneth Price of Issaquah. The Reverend Leslie Braxton has taken the, quote, culture of victimization, quote, to a new level. He is organizing, quote, strategic strikes as a way of bringing awareness to, and then in parentheses, PC4 complain about, the Seattle police treatment of African-American males. Wouldn't it be more correct and more productive to spend the time in his own community changing behavior of those victims? Every time an African-American male is involved in a protestable episode with the Seattle police, he is either pulling a gun, raising a sword, dragging the Seattle policeman down the street in the car, or fleeing the scene of the crime. When the Seattle police start shooting law-abiding African-American males, I will be on the protest line next to the Reverend, but not until then. Get your act together, Reverend, and quit these strategic strikes, which will just end up reducing your credibility to your cause.
Oh, I like that guy.
And the last one, Peter Mann will love. This is probably the only one that I disagree with. Totally, outright, 100%.
Well, I disagreed with the very first one, too.
But this one, I think you'll disagree with 1,000 times more than the first one.
Okay. I'm ready.
It's from Kimberly Folgum. Has it occurred to anyone that nobody would have died if either Robert Lee Thomas Sr. nor Melvin Miller had been packing guns? I think that nobody would have died if Miller hadn't, or if Robert Lee Thomas Sr. hadn't had a stolen gun.
Yeah, or if he had...
But according to Thomas Jr., they died because they didn't move the car in time.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has a different opinion on why they died that day. It seems like they're a dime a dozen, especially after everything you just got done reading there.
Right.
But to try and blame guns for this, I mean, it's responsibility. If the guy hadn't been in possession of a stolen gun, if the guy had been smart enough to know you don't pull a gun on somebody unless you're ready to shoot him,
right.
If the guy had been smart enough, which he wasn't because he was doing drugs, I mean, there's a lot of things you can point to as why they died, but to say that if they hadn't had guns, everything would just be fine and dandy is just stupid.
Yeah. I think in the end, you know, there's going to be, you know, I still have a few questions about what took place between the time Miller went to the truck and the time that Thomas was shot. I'd like to see those filled in. And I'm not saying that it's impossible that there was that it was a totally racist act. I'm not saying that that's impossible, but from the evidence that has been given to everybody, it's not that case. It's not the case now.
Mm-hmm.
And by the fact that a guy's been a cop for 19 years, for him to all of a sudden decide to start acting out as a racist seems sort of odd. But that's not to say it couldn't happen, and I'm not going to rule that out. But I think the whole point of today is showing that without all the facts, people have already decided that the cop acted out because the man was black, the man who was black mm-hmm. died because the man was black in a lily white neighborhood.
Yep.
And I think those are the things that need to be addressed. And if...
But, you know, really, my nice stutter there, I don't... No matter what the facts are in that little in-between time, if the facts that we've been given so far are correct, I mean, Miller could have been the biggest racist in the history of the world. The reason Thomas died is because he pulled a gun and pointed it at Miller. And Miller returned in kind and fired. Responded in kind and fired. That's why he's dead. I don't care if Miller was the biggest race in the history of the world.
No,
and
what,
had a whole bunch of racial slurs going
on
there.
What I was saying, though, Peter, was there's a possibility that the story that Miller gave was wrong and he was racist and he went out there and
killed
him.
I understand that.
And that Thomas never pulled a gun.
That's why I said, I understand what you're saying. That's why I prefaced my comment with, if the facts we've been given so far are indeed accurate. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is the Peter Eichmann Show.
That concludes. Yeah.
And we are going to turn it over to Sylvia when she gets in. And once again, you can hit our website at www.informationtechnologyprofessionals.com if you have any, if you'd like to download this show or any other show. This one will probably be up in a couple days. It usually takes a couple days. Turn around for me these days since I'm working in other locations. And we will turn you over to the Reverend.
Yeah.
Good night.